Yeah, what's up, everyone? How's it going? This is Tom McCaffrey. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for downloading. And please join our Patreon, LE2B, for bonus content and for behind the scenes videos. What's up?
How's it going?
Good. What's happening? I know I had just mentioned Succession ended about a week ago. And you know, that was a really big deal, the finale. But you don't really watch it, so I guess we can't really.
No. Well, you know, I'm just finding anything I can on TV now with the writer's strike. There was actually something good. You have a chance to take, it's sort of an ad for themselves, but it was like 100 Years of Warner Brothers. It's on HBO Max. They just released it. And they just they go through, like, you know, the beginning, the silent film era, and then up to the 80s and 90s and today, all their movies that they did. They're a pretty good studio. Like, they kind of had some great movies, and they were known to be pretty edgy. One thing I didn't know is that Clint Eastwood does all his movies with Warner Brothers. He started with them, and he would only do it with them.
Yeah. What is he? So he still makes movies even though he's like 98.
I don't know.
How is he? There's no way he's doing those. Like, he directs like two movies a year in his 90s. It's like, yeah. I've been on movie sets. Making movies is really hard.
I think he just like,
imagine he's in charge on the set.
I think it's what I hear is that, like, people like that, someone else does it, and then they just show him the iPad and they go, "This is the shot. Is this okay?" And he's like,
"Yeah." He's like, "Oh, TV off. Sir, we're filming right now. Why doesn't my son call?" It's amazing how he's, you know, he just keeps making movies. Maybe he just has a very, I feel like he looks like he's been 90 for like 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. They also said Kubrick would always like to do his movies with, starting with like Clockwork Orange, he'd like to do all his movies with Warner Brothers.
So what do you think? I know we talked about the writer's strike last time. Obviously, it's still, you know, early on. It's the early stages. But what do you think? I think it's one of those things where there's an inevitability of things shifting and you can, you know, kind of figure things out and renegotiate. But there's this kind of like this elephant in the room that things are about to really change and things have already been shaken up so much that it reminds me of like when Napster happened and they kept trying so hard to like put that toothpaste back in the bottle. Yeah. Like, we need to get rid of that. We need to not have that. It's like, no, it's like, but I mean, it's kind of like you guys are going to have to figure out a new way to make money. And it took, I feel like that's kind of what's going on with them. And no one really wants to.
Right. I think the directors just settled with the studios, the Directors Guild. So that was not good because there wasn't a lot of solidarity there.
Yeah.
So I was reading about it as kind of like a divide and conquer strategy. And, yeah, you know, directors are going to settle because their deal is always good. You know, I'm assuming that if you're a director of a movie, you're going to get paid well.
Yeah. I mean, definitely have a lot more leverage. I mean, it's basically your whole thing. Right. This is one thing. Did you watch, have you heard that show, The Idol, that just premiered last night?
The Idol, is that with The Weeknd?
Yeah, The Weeknd. And
what's his real name, though? He uses his real name.
The Weeknights. I don't know his real name.
His real name is Prince Rogers Nelson, I think.
Yeah, his real name is M. Night Shyamalan. No, I don't know. He has a name. I forgot it. It's not like a normal. Not. It's just not an easy name.
It's it's Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's Johnny Depp's daughter.
Yeah. Nepo baby. Abel Macon Testasa. I can't even pronounce this. Abel Macon.
I'm just going to call him Weeknd.
Yeah. I think that was the right move.
Yeah. So
I heard this show is like so dirty, right?
Well, I mean, you know, it's the same guy who created Euphoria. So
okay.
You know, that really pushing envelope, Did you watch Euphoria? It's amazing that it took me so long to get into it, because it was just kind of like, I watched it later and I'm like, what the hell was I like, what was I holding out for? It's like just a bunch of young high school, hot high school chicks naked and banging everyone.
I'm right.
Like, for a while, I was like, I'm not interested.
I mean, it was, I mean, I watched like the first season or so, but I don't know. These shows get they get so dirty after a while. Just watch porn. Why do you need these shows to be so dirty? I don't understand.
Well, I guess I got into Euphoria later, and I do. Mm-hmm. I like it. It's good. I mean, it's a really compelling,
yeah,
it's almost like a high school show made by like Martin Scorsese.
Right.
But so this is kind of like, the problem is he always has to keep pushing the envelope now. So it's like, he's going to try and make it more risque. And
is this Levinson's kid? Is that who's doing it?
Is that who he is? Is it Sam Levinson or something?
Let me see. Because that's another nepo right there.
Totally.
What's it called again? Idol.
The Idol, yeah. And she's like a pop star who's kind of trying to make a comeback. I guess she's kind of going through like a PR night. It's basically just all about fame now, mm-hmm. and how, what it is and what it entails. And I was, I was talking to my girlfriend. I was saying like, you know, there was a time where I like thought it'd be really cool to be famous. And I think like I would want to be famous, but not now. Like, I feel like I would want to be famous like 15 years ago. Like, being famous now, I don't even know what it is anymore. It's just kind of like, the people who are famous are just, they're not really doing anything really worthwhile. They're just, they've kind of hacked an algorithm, and it's just, I don't even know what it and it, I feel like,
I think there's a lot more famous people now because of social media. So I think, does it water it down a little bit? I would say so.
I think it waters it down. And I think it's like, there's so many landmines now.
Right.
There's so many traps where it's just, I feel like all that Me Too stuff and all that. So that is going to sound really bad, but the scrutiny and social media and everyone having access to you just ruined being like, what's the upside of being famous now? It's just, everyone can tell you suck. Everyone's mad at you. Anyone can reach you at any time.
Right.
If you do it, it became a thing of like, oh, you can't. If you're kind of, inappropriate to someone a little bit, they don't like what you did, they can just ruin you in a day. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, or you could like,
do anything.
You could be like Danny Matheson and like rape 4 people and then have to go to jail for it. What's that all about?
I know, like they took all the fun out of being famous. And I mean, the thing is like, I'm like kind of kidding, but I feel like I'm not, the whole rape thing, obviously that's,
you did know, you hear though that he got convicted?
Yeah. And I feel like that's another good, kind of litmus test and, gauge of how different things are. Cause I remember that guy in the aughts and the 90s, all those guys were just like on their lives were just like, we're based, like, if you were famous in the aughts, your life was basically like Entourage. That's right. What fame was. And that was how they depicted fame in pop culture. It was just kind of like, yeah, you get everything and everything's great and it never stops. And then now it's like the Idol is kind of what fame is now, which is like a constant PR scramble. Like,
right.
You constantly have to put out fires and it's like,
But in his case, I mean, it was kind of ridiculous.
Masterson?
Yeah, I was reading about it. I mean, and a lot of it is Scientology related. Like, he raped these women. Like, and
yeah.
And it was like part of the whole thing that they did there. I don't know. I mean, that whole Scientology thing. I was kind of reading about that today. It's just like, they have this thing called fair game, where if you speak out against the church after you leave, they just fucking go after you. They'll like kill your dog and fucking ruin your, ruin your career and things like that.
Yeah.
And he got, I guess, I don't know. I don't know if that was part of what he was doing, but he's going to go to jail for a while.
Yeah. He's facing up to 30 years. I think, I mean, that guy could be in jail for like 20 years. I mean, hide from that 70s show. Like,
I heard it because they had the 90s show and they didn't invite him back for that.
Well, I mean, I hope not. They're like, I think that was a no-brainer. Like, what about that guy who raped everyone? No, let's have a pet. Anyway, it's not like he was even like, it's just funny looking at that and how that show is such a big thing and everyone from the cast was such hot shit. And now it's just kind of like, first of all, why is he raping people? Like, I mean, I know you're crazy in Scientology and but it's like, just, you're like famous and rich and like you have all this power. Just,
no, but I think it goes back to the Cosby thing. These guys are, it's a power thing for them, man. Why? I mean, like James Franco, I don't even think he raped women, but why did he have to set up an acting school to get laid? It's obviously some weird power thing, you know? Why did Cosby?
Right.
I mean, I figured that
why does he have to do that? Like, I mean, I should be starting an acting school.
But 2003, Danny Masterson was like, he was hanging out with those other two guys, you know? They were probably women were throwing themselves at him.
That's
Like, but it had nothing to do with that. It's these people are just, you know, it's not about the sex. It's about, you know, power and stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously.
And I think I think Scientology doesn't help. I don't think that really centers you as a person, you know, morally.
I think they just say whatever you do. Well, I think they always were like, whatever you do, we can fix it for you. We can,
right.
You know, whoever's going after you who knows something, we'll just blackmail them or fuck with their heads.
Yeah, this is just another kind of chink in their armor. Like they don't seem as powerful anymore.
No.
I'm surprised they convicted because they had a mistrial and then I thought that was going to be it, but they did it again. And
I mean, it's hard. It was 20 years ago too. But I also was reading about how I think he was like some sort of DJ actor before he was famous, and then all of a sudden he got on that show and whatever, a sitcom, and it's like. I think the Scientology gets people work when they're coming up. I think they really do. I always believe that. And
yeah.
They own your career and then you got to give part of your money to them and like kind of promote them maybe. So if you're a struggling actor in Hollywood and you go to a meeting and they go, listen, you know, you join us and we're going to get you a sitcom.
Right.
I don't know. I think a lot of people would go for that.
Tomorrow.
After your acting school that folded, right?
Yeah, well, welcome to Tommy Acting Academy. All right, so we're going to do some scenes. Here they are. This one's from Edward Penis Hands.
We're going to do, we're going to do Death of a Salesman. You know the part where Willie Loman has sex with five girls naked? You know that part? We're going to recreate that part.
It was in the original production. I don't have any lines in this scene. Don't worry about it. Just take off your pants. No, it's just like, why, like, of all people, that's what, like, some total scumbags were you, and not James. I mean, we've talked about this before, but it's just like, I think what it is he probably does like doing things like teaching acting. He probably is into that, but then he just gets so caught up in, like, he's so horny and he just wants to, you know, bank all that. And, you know, I'm sure that they were into him, some of them. So I think it gets dicey with those guys, you know, because I think so many women are into them that what happens is they can't believe when someone's not into them. It almost seems unfathomable to them. Like,
yeah.
What are you talking about? Like, I don't think they believe it even.
All right. We're going to bring in a guest here in a minute, but, let's see if this guest is here yet. But anyway, what were we talking about? Let's move on to a different subject. There she is.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, what's up? How you doing?
Good. I just make sure. Sorry about that. This is one of those days where I was just interviewing someone about a lesbian love triangle of monkeys at an animal sanctuary. And, you know.
Yeah.
In Agua Dulce, California, and now I'm at my mom's house. So seems like a perfect trajectory for a good Monday.
Okay, yeah, perfect. We were just
Franco. Why did you do the intro?
You didn't stop, right? We're still going.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So our guest is a comedian and an anthropologist, and. I met her a long time ago on John Fugelsang's Sirius XM radio show, and she's a comedian. Please give it up for Natalia Reagan. How are you? Thank you for being here.
Yay. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I was trying to figure out when we met. We met like 2018 or 19, right?
I think so. Yeah. It was definitely at Sirius. It was like back when you still would go into Sirius XM to do the shows.
Yeah. Now it's a ghost town.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I've been in there since COVID. I was in there right before COVID, but I haven't been in there since, which I guess you don't really, because you do those shows a lot, right? Like
I do John's show pretty much every week. I was there a couple weeks ago and I swear a tumbleweed just greeted me as I walked in. It really is. I mean, it is empty. And I mean, then again, he has the late night hour now. He's like, whatever, 9 to midnight on the East Coast.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's actually cool. I think I did it once. I did another show later, and I liked it better. I liked going in there late at night.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of feels, I don't know, after hours, after dark.
Yeah.
How are you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Good. I was going to, so, you know, let's get into it. Like, you obviously, you know, the thing that people probably talk to you about, you know, first and foremost is you do comedy, but also you're a scientist, right?
Yeah. I like to keep it weird.
So how did that happen exactly?
So it's a good question. I started when I was young. I used to have recurring King Kong nightmares as a child, and he would eat me. He would eat my family one by one, and then eventually eat me. The whole "you don't die in your dreams" is a bunch of bullshit, because I've been, you know, decimated by Kong many times.
Is that really?
Yeah, yeah. I used to get eaten by. I mean, do you guys die in your dreams?
I thought when you die in your dreams, you die in real life. Wasn't that part of the Freddy Krueger movies, or no? I guess that's not real.
I mean, spoiler alert, I'm just a ghost. And that's what we...
Wow. This is
I die a lot. But the first time I ever was able to lucid dream, I was 8 years old, and I thought King Kong down in size. Like, I remember hearing the footsteps in the distance, and I like just wished him to be small. And by the time he got to the door, he was an orangutan, and he hugged me. And it was like, from then on out, I had Stockholm syndrome, and I just wanted to, you know, to be the Fay Wray to his King Kong. And but so I thought I was going to be a zoologist when I was a kid. And then I got older, and I was flailing in math and science. And so I decided if I couldn't chase monkeys, I was going to do the next best thing, which was comedy, and went to theater school. and I ended up dropping out, but worked in the film industry. So I was an actress, and, you know, doing stand-in and extra work. You've seen the back of my head in a lot of TV shows, you know, Drew Carey Show, My Name is Earl, and stuff like that, playing little roles here and there. But then I took one anthropology class in college, and I fell in love with it, but I didn't know what to do with it. It was like one of those like weird moments where I was like, I love this, but what does one do with this? And then I got hit by a truck. Ooh. And at 25 on the shoulder of the freeway as a pedestrian, and like you do. And that kind of was the, yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. All right. So you were walking down the highway?
You know, playing in the highway. You know, your parents tell you to go do that. Go, why don't we go play in the highway? I took it literally. No, it's a freak accident. And as a lawyer, you probably, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of a case like this, but these things happen. I rear-ended somebody on the freeway. I was the 101 at the 405 interchange. They pulled over onto the shoulder. I pulled over behind them. I knew how dangerous this was, right? Like, I'm from LA. So I'm just like, this is dangerous. And I got out of the car, they got out, and I was crying. And I said, hey, can we get off the shoulder? It's really dangerous. And there were three Japanese men in town on business who didn't speak any English. And I was like, son of a bitch, you know, and one of them's holding his neck. And so I went to go grab my insurance. And of course, couldn't find it. So I called my little brother, who just had his wisdom teeth out, and he's hopped up on, you know, Vicodin, and he's, you know, recovering. And I was like, hey, can you go grab your insurance? And I was standing between my pickup truck and the car I rear-ended as far from the freeway as possible, but the cars are zooming past, you know? And I remember I heard it before I saw it. I heard a loud rumble and then a crash. And then I just kind of put my hands up, and I'd like to think I said not the face, but it was probably like, you know, oof. Shit, cocksucker kind of thing.
What do you remember next?
I remember the immediate impact, and I remember thinking I'm dead. Like, there's no way one's surviving this. And then I remember coming to. So once they were like loading me into the ambulance, and it was really bright, and I remember thinking, this has to be a dream. It hurt really bad.
But there was were no monkeys in the dream, so you knew it wasn't.
There were no, yeah. Not even a flying monkey. It was quite disappointing. But
that's always disappointing.
It is. And just so you know, the last thing I said, I was leaving my boyfriend's house when this happened. The last thing I said to him before I drove a pickup truck, I climbed in and I looked at him and I said, I'm not wearing any underwear.
Oh, and boy.
So they did have to cut off my pants on the shoulder of the freeway, which must have been a real show for everyone. But that was the first thing I remember, was being loaded in and them asking for my phone number, and then kind of in and out of consciousness while I got to the hospital. But they had to do, I got hit, I broke my femur, and then I got pinned, and then I got thrown. So
what was the recovery from that like?
It was rough, but it was all, I mean, I had a lot of good friends and family around me, but I had to learn how to walk again. I couldn't walk. All the ligaments and tendons connecting to my foot on the right leg were severed. I broke my femur. I landed on my head. So I had a pretty bad concussion, and it explains quite a bit. Yeah. And I punctured my lungs.
And that's when you decided to become a comic right after that. Mm-hmm. You're like, this is,
yeah, that's smacked
it
everything.
It usually takes some head trauma to get into comedy.
Well, I don't want you to, I'm glad you're better. I just want to, if you don't mind me getting back to the monkey stuff for a second, one second.
Absolutely.
Because I have a question. Did your love of monkeys, do you have a unnatural love of monkeys, possibly?
Some would call it unnatural.
Right. Okay.
No, but I do. I do love non-human primates. I love animals. If you know me, I'm that person at a party that if there is a cat or a dog or a bearded dragon or you name, insert the weird animal there, I will leave the humans and be alone with that animal, just trying to become its best friend or get to know it.
So. Yeah, that's I get that, because especially the older I get, the more when I go to parties, I'd rather hang out with the animals.
was King Kong the reason why you first got into animals? Was that it?
That was, as a kid, I think that was, I just remember being terrified, but also enamored early on. You know, I was scared of King Kong.
See, that's a good way to get into monkeys. Like, that's, you see King Kong, you're like, oh, that's a good way to get into monkeys. Like, if you went to the zoo and your first experience with monkeys were monkeys, you know, they throw their shit. Mm-hmm. I think that you might have gone a different way. You know, if that was your first monkey experience.
Yeah, no, I think this was a, you know,
and by the way,
I think being murdered by King Kong was a much more positive.
Yeah, definitely a better spin. No, for sure. I did when I worked on Star Talk, we did a segment at, it's called Project Chimps in Georgia. And her name was Gertrude. She was a chimpanzee. We locked eyes and she immediately shit in her hand and threw it at me. And we became poo sisters. And And I sponsor Gertrude.
I think that's how me and Eric first met.
Yeah. Why do monkeys do that? Why do they throw their poop?
It's a good question. So in many cases, like for instance, when I did field work, I worked in Panama and, you know, I worked in Costa Rica and Nicaragua. They don't throw it. They just simply place their bottom directly over your head and let her rip. Right. Like, why shit in your hand? That's just, it's much more convenient to do it that way. But I mean, things like lack of enrichment, boredom, you know, because the thing is, like, if you put us in an enclosure for, you know, an indefinite amount of time, we would probably do some pretty extreme things, and perhaps defecate in our hand and throw it is one of them. So I mean, a lot of times it's,
yeah, if you took someone's phone away from them, I think after a while they would just do that, throw their poop.
Yes,
at, yeah,
that would definitely happen. I think
it might take me a couple of hours without a phone. But can I, so when did you, so after that accident, is that when you started studying? You were like, I'm going to be a scientist now? Or was,
yeah,
that?
It took time. It's one of those things where I feel like everything is, hindsight is 20/20, you know, like I look back at my life and I realized that was a huge catalyst of what that, cause I was a stand in on a TV show. Like, I actually tell a story about this, about how, I was living a life I didn't really recognize. You know, I thought I was going to be an actress, and, you know, I ended up being like, you know, an extra on a stand-in and everybody else's. And I was like, what am I doing? And there's nothing wrong with that kind of work. It's just not what I wanted. And I was like, I'd been taking classes at Santa Monica College before that, and mostly biological anthropology classes. And I'd fallen in love with it. And again, and I realized that there was a world out there to behold. And so I went back to school, to Cal State Northridge, and I finished up my undergrad. And while I was there, I discovered that a lot of our electronics have this heat resistant mineral in it called coltan, and coltan, 80% of the world's coltan is found in Africa, and 80% of Africa's coltan is found in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Oh, wow. And there was this massive like rush, this, they called it the Black Rush, to get this coltan. In like around 2000, and when the tech boom of 2000 busted, you know, a lot of the locals there had to turn to alternative means to make money, like anybody would. And so part of it was, you know, bushmeat hunting. And so gorillas were getting, you know, sometimes killed and sold for bushmeat, or, you know, like their hands would be turned into ashtrays. And, you know, they were trying to find alternatives to, you know, either financial alternatives or even like, you know, economic alternatives for locals in the area. And so I kind of got involved in, I mean, it sounds silly, but a roundabout way doing cell phone recycling. You know, I started a cell phone recycling, because that's the thing is like, because we have this built for obsolescence in the Western world, everything's built to break. We're constantly buying new electronics, which drives the need for this mineral, which drives this mining, which sometimes ultimately bleeds into conservation efforts. And that's the thing, is like everything is connected, right? And that's kind of one of those moments that I realized, you know, everything is kind of, you have to approach it holistically and look at the big picture. And even like with conservation, I'm a big believer that it can't just be animal based. It has to be, how can we take care of the people in the area? You know, because if their needs aren't met, you can't fault them for doing what they got to do to survive. Right. So that's how I kind of got into it. And then I wanted to work with gorillas, but it was too dangerous. So I pivoted and I did spider monkeys instead. And they're just, they're a rollicking good time, guys.
Now they like you, right? So you're kind of like, you know, was it Diane Fossey? Who's the one where she was in with the gorillas?
So Diane Fossey was gorillas, Jane Goodall chimps, and Brute Galdikas was orangutans. They were the Louis Leakey called them, well, he didn't call them this, but people would call them Leakey's angels, but they were the ones that were charged to and given the opportunity, because they were so good at what they did, to study the great apes. But now I study spider monkeys, and there's a lot of my advisor, Christina Campbell, is a great spider monkey researcher, and I got to learn from the best. And they're the best weight loss plan ever is to study spider monkeys. Let me just tell you.
What exactly are they? Just the small ones?
Why is it the best weight loss? I'm curious.
Because they are fast. They're called semi-brachiators. So there's different modes of locomotion. Like, how do primates move? There's those that walk on all fours, the quadrupedal movement, knuckle walkers that you see in gorillas and chimps. But then there are brachiators, true brachiators like gibbons. If you've ever seen a gibbon, they're the ones that swing with great stealth and ease through the forest. But spider monkeys are semi-brachiators, meaning they move almost as quickly, and they take off. And in the area that I worked at, they were not used to humans. They weren't habituated. So they were fearful of us. And so they would just take off swinging through the trees. And it was very treacherous ground. And the reason why there was still forests in the areas that I did field work was because it was too steep to cut down. So I called, and this is after my accident. So I'm missing a muscle in my right leg that's responsible for balance. So I called myself the Jack Tripper of primatology, because I would fall uphill. I would fall downhill. I fell in love that summer. It was wild, but so
where was that? Where would you do the field work?
This was on the Azuero Peninsula in Panama. So it's on the Pacific.
Oh, wow.
Pacific coast. Yeah. It's gorgeous. I was in the process of trying to buy property there last year, and it fell apart, but to build a primate field school. But essentially it's a tropical dry forest. So if you've been to Costa Rica or Panama or, you know, different areas of Central America, it can be very hot and humid. It's still hot and humid, but it's a little bit more temperate. They actually have seasons there. So during the dry season, you know, like the trees will lose their leaves, you know, and it's super freaking hot and dry. And then the wet season is supremely damp.
Can I ask you, this is a random question, but you grew up in LA, right?
Yeah.
So what is LA like, and what's a misconception people have about LA? Because I mean, you know, a lot of people go there, and not a lot of people actually. I don't. It seems like when you go there, a lot of people are transplants from somewhere else. But what was that like growing up there? What's like a misconception people have about it?
That's a great question. Yeah. So LA is funny because it is a town of transplants, like New York. It's a town of transplants. People are constantly moving in and out. I think a big misconception is that Angelenos are not nice and that we're fake. Trust me, that exists, right? Even people that are born and raised here can be fake. But I think for the most part, I mean, we're people think I'm from the Midwest and the South all the time. You know, people I'll meet here are like, where are you from? You're so nice. And I'm like, I was born in Van Nuys, conceived in Kentucky, but born in Van Nuys.
Do you still like it there? I mean, you still live there, right? So you still?
I do. But I moved to New York for a reason. In 2017, I moved there to work with Neil on Star Talk. But I had kind of looked at LA is like a ghost town where every street corner, every, you know, I drive past buildings or neighborhoods, and it was like there was weird memories attached to every place, like you have in a place that you grew up. And it was wearing on me, and I needed something different, you know? And so I think moving to New York gave me that perspective.
And probably not enough spider monkeys in LA, I would imagine. It doesn't seem like,
you know, it is. There was a spider monkey at the Playboy Mansion.
Was there?
Her name was Coco, and I got to have intense eye contact and lip smacking with her.
Are you serious?
And, yeah, I did. I was a gatekeeper at a Playboy Mansion party for the Bruno Mars cover party. They needed a girl that had half a brain that looked good in a dress. That's what they told me, and I was like, okay, I'm in. And I met Coco. I knew there was a spider monkey on the property. And I remember I was snarfing a piece of pizza right before they opened the party. And I was like literally shoveling it in my mouth. And spider monkeys make this sound where they do, it's almost like they're clearing their throat. They do. And we did it back and forth to each other. And then all of a sudden I hear somebody turning the corner, and it was Bruno Mars and his entourage.
Wow.
And I was like, hi. Hello.
And then the spider monkey threw poop on both of you, or?
Mm-hmm. And then we ran off and had a lovely night in the grotto. That's how we do, you know?
So that was a pet, because I'm Googling, and or you can answer this question. Are spider monkeys safe pets?
No.
Yes, that is the correct answer, according to Google.
Yeah, so I actually have done several videos about this, how primates make terrible, terrible pets. And also I volunteer at an animal sanctuary called Animal Tracks. I was just there today filming or recording about a lesbian monkey love triangle, like you do. But they take in a lot of former pet monkeys. And, you know, when you expect a highly sentient, smart, intelligent creature to, you know, live with you and your family and behave like a human and take it away from its own kind, it's really cruel. And you're also opening up the door for a lot of hellacious behavior, you know, because they have the brain power and the dexterity to choose to make your life a living hell, you know?
Yeah. So how did you, after you had studied anthropology and you graduated, how were you kind of like, did you take a step back and you were like, how can I combine this with comedy? And how did you do that?
Yeah. So, you know, in 2010, I started, I've always wanted to combine the two. Weirdly, I always thought that would be a great combination. I was in an improv troupe for many years in my 20s, and I would always try to include weird science stuff in it. But I started pitching science comedy shows in 2010 while I was finishing up grad school. And I remember the first one I pitched was called The Sordid Lives of Primates. And the production company just kind of looked at me like, huh? Like what? What's going on? And they were very nice, but like they weren't, you know, they were not ready. And I mean, perhaps the world was not ready. But there was like sock monkey puppets, sketch comedy. It was like Pee Wee's Playhouse meets, you know, SNL meets, you know, Conan O'Brien. It was real weird and wacky. But
I think you should pitch lesbian monkey love triangle. I think that one would go well.
Yes, I agreed. In fact, that I'm podcasting for Scientific American, and that will be my first one. So yeah, I think this is going to be a hit.
Doesn't that sound like a name of like some sort of like, you know, like alt band, lesbian, right? Monkey love triangle.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
I liked them before they were popular.
Right. Yeah. You know, their first album should just be Scissor Sisters, you know, but, yeah,
so
did that
not go very far? And then after what happened with it?
It didn't go far with other companies, but a friend of mine was like, yo, you write comedy, you perform, you have a camera. Cause when I did field work, I was filming a lot of the stuff that I was, you know, out in the field doing and taking pictures of the monkeys. He's like, why don't you make your own stuff? And he was right. And the very first video that I made was called The Story of Boobs, The Breast Tale Ever Told, about the evolution of breasts in human women, because non-human primates don't have tatas like we do. This is specific to Homo sapiens. So I did a video about how when we evolved from Miocene apes, like, so when we were, you know, going off in our direction and, you know, going on our lineage, becoming upright walking bipeds, our sexual swellings, because our closest genetic relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos, when they're ready to get down, they get these massive sexual swellings. You know, we talk about monkey butts, or eight butts. Mm-hmm. Usually that's not their butt, you know, that's their front butt, but it's in the back because that's how they're positioned. And so, but once we stood up, one of the theories is that, you know, signals shifted up towards the chest, and that breasts, you know, females get, you know, fat around their mammary glands at puberty when they are in theory receptive. But we know now, like, let's wait till someone's 18, folks. I'm not trying to give you permission, but you know, we get these breasts that stick around and they're a signal to the opposite sex. Also, that fat around the mammary gland, another idea is that when we breastfeed, because our faces, if you look at a chimpanzee profile, it's very prognathic. That means it juts out quite a bit. But humans, we have really flat faces. So if you put a flat face up against a flat titte, you're going to smother your baby. You know, it's not a bad way to go in the scheme of things, but still.
Yeah. I just want to say full disclosure, because you were talking about evolution. Me and Tom don't believe in evolution. This is actually a religious show. So, you know, okay. Adam and Eve. Let's keep it to
Adam,
that.
Adam and Steve. Can we gay it up a little bit? What about gays? Is that cool?
You even know, I've been reading more stories. I mean, you know how we're just kind of backsliding in this country. Now it's like the flat earth stuff. And now I'm reading about, like, they won't want to teach evolution in certain schools now, I'm reading. And it's like, didn't we settle this like 100 years ago? I mean,
I thought we did. I really did.
I think that I just read that in Florida, they're going to stop teaching reading. So,
everything will be on TikTok.
So I know this is going to be an odd question, but, you know, like, evolution, you know, breasts developing in women, you know, evolution as an evolutionary thing. Why?
This is a subject Tom thinks about a lot. So go ahead.
I'm like, how can I ask this and sound like it's like a real scientific question or inquiry? No, but in terms of the disparity between, like, you know, like, why? I mean, I don't know if there's even a way to explain it, but, like, you know, some might be really well endowed and then others not really at all. If it's an evolutionary thing, why would some continue to still have, you know, an abundance and then some not? You know what I mean? It seems like it would have tapered off to like a medium in between at some point, or
we could argue about that with a lot of anatomy, if you know what I mean. But
that's true. Yeah.
I think about that a lot.
Why do some get endowed with much and some with little? I mean, that's a great question. And I mean, again, a lot of
things. That's what dudes are always asking me. They're like, why did some get so much? And I'm like, I don't know, man.
I mean, I don't know.
And then people look at me and like, your thing looks like a monkey's butt. And
like, that's my back.
Thanks. I mean,
isn't there even an answer for that? I mean, like,
Just human variation. I mean, there's a lot of shapes and sizes, and, you know, there's you know, even like if we look at, so I talk about this when I talk about human evolution, the idea of how do you split a species, like, especially if it's something that's already extinct, how do you like draw lines between, okay, this is Homo erectus and this is Homo habilis, but this is not that, you know, one is not the other. And it's like, where do you draw the line? Is it age? Is it brain size, or, you know, brain or cranial capacity? Is it different, you know, how many morphological traits, and which ones count more than others? And there's those people that try to lump things together, and those, you know, like, different, you know, there's certain ones that are outliers that are like, oh, let's just lump it in with Homo habilis. Let's just, you know, meh. And some are like, no, let's split it off into its own thing because there's benefits to that. Like, you know, you can get more money if you've discovered a new species, you know, grant money, more, you know, fame or whatever. But there's a lot of variation within species, and especially humans. There's not a lot of genetic variation. I'll put that out there. There's actually very little genetic variation within our species. I mean, we're like 99.9% the same, you know. And there's, in fact, the most genetic diversity is within peoples in Africa, not me and somebody from Africa. There's more genetic diversity there because that is where our species began. And so it's this idea that, like, a founder's effect, where there's more genetic diversity when something starts out, and then it spreads off, and then it becomes less and less.
How close are humans to monkeys, like, genetically speaking, or gorillas or whatever?
It depends on which monkeys. I mean, like, chimpanzees were about, like, almost like 99% identical. Orangutans, I think orangutans are like 96, 97. Gorillas are in that a little bit more than that. Monkeys, it really depends on old world versus new world. I don't know off the top of my head.
Can you comment or like theorize where we are as a species evolution wise?
We're young. I'll tell you that much. We're very young.
But so where do we go? Where do you see it going? It seems like it's devolving. Like see the movie Idiocracy?
I sure as hell did. Yep.
So I feel like that was a joke and everything, but I feel like we're going there about 500 years early.
Right. But that's our brain power. I think our bodies are actually getting bigger though. Right. I think in the last 100 years, I think taller.
Yeah. I mean, if you talk to the Scandinavians, yeah, they're always, I feel like the Dutch, just forget it. I'm like, I'm a little person in the Netherlands. But I think, you know, it really does depend on, you know, across the world. I mean, there are places in the world where people are not necessarily getting bigger because that really depends on a lot of factors. It's not just one thing. Mm-hmm. It's nutrition. You know, that really can stunt somebody's growth if they don't have good nutrition growing up, and certain diseases and can also affect that as well. But as far as like, you know, de-evolving, evolution is not a goal-driven process. You know, it's not something like, okay, like we're
going to get here.
Having adaptations that help you survive into next generations is not something that is necessarily like, you know, we're trying to, you know, if a better brain suits us, then that's great. That's awesome. If it suits us to have a tail that can, you know, be like a prehensile tail that can manipulate, let you be manipulated like a fifth arm, that's great. But it's not like, okay, evolution's like, you know, okay, what next? You know, it's more
third about, nipple.
Right. Third nipple is definitely next. But things like, you know, even like wisdom teeth that we don't really use anymore because we have, you know, we eat so much processed food and our diets have changed so much since the advent of agriculture. You know, we see chimpanzees and bonobos, you know, and our close genetic relatives using that wisdom tooth, and we're not really using it anymore. And so that might go away. And the appendix, which is, you know.
Yeah. Well, even for men with just nipples in general, like why do we have them?
It's one of those things where it's they're kind of like universals where it's like there's no reason to take them out. They don't like cause any harm. Right. So it's like, you know, we start off basically, you know, with the female development and it's like, might as well just keep them, you know, they're doing no harm. So like give that dude some nips. And I do know some dudes that get pleasure from their nips.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So they do serve some purpose in some way, right? They are like an erotic,
right?
Zone, erogenous zone for erotic zone.
And what's going on with the evolution? Because I've also noticed men's breasts getting bigger, some of them. So
that's age.
I mean, everything, gravity is a cruel mistress. Well, part of it is, I mean, what diet and things of that sort. I know that higher rates of estrogen, you know, can affect a man's teats, means, if you will, man teats. What you eat, in medications and things of that sort, you know.
And also the fact that we don't have to really go out and like kill things.
This is also right. I mean, so speak for yourself, Tom. I just strangled. No, I'm just kidding. I never.
I forgot you're an LA.
She's a hunter. Yeah. You're a gatherer. So let her do her.
Believe me, I've always talked about that. Like I would have been one of those gatherers. I would have been the dude who's like, I'm just going to hang back here and like clean up a little bit.
I mean, gathering is so easy. Cool? Come on. I mean, come on.
Well, even now I there's different, archaeologists and paleoanthropologists that are really tackling this idea, the sort of false narrative of man the hunter, female the gatherer, and how it was probably a little bit more of a give and take, you know, in terms of roles. And even like this idea of gender is pretty darn new in the idea that it's this super fixed binary. No, and that's why like a lot of the stuff I talk about is like about the, you know, a lot of cultures throughout the world have had multiple genders. And I was even making and animals that have like, you know, parthenogenesis where they actually can, you know, mate with themselves, you know, or be a kind of being both, they have a reproductive organs.
Like frogs, right?
Males and females. Frogs, nudibranchs. I was making a video. I do videos about sending nudes and sending newts, Oh, time nudes. Sending nudes. Like, yeah, I'll send you. They're very funny. It's, yeah. Hi, did you ask for some nudes? Here is an Eastern red spotted newt. But I did one on nudibranchs last night because they actually have both male and female reproductive organs. So they can kind of like switch it, you know, they can flip it. So I don't know. But it's just funny to me that humans are so obsessed with binaries and compartmentalizing everything and putting everything in boxes. It helps us understand the world, but also I think it can be detrimental because I just feel bad for people that are so stuck in the binary that it like they'll lose their mind if somebody is using a they, them pronoun. And it's like, really, that's going to be the thing that kills you? Like, okay.
But you're saying the gatherers weren't all women.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, there probably was a mix of sharing responsibility. It wasn't like, okay, everyone.
Because I was reading it. They said that the gatherers made 77% of what the hunters made. So I figured it would just be all, you know, I thought it was all women. So
I mean, gatherers do bring in more calories. I don't know if they get paid as much. Probably.
I mean, I would have. I definitely would have been. I don't know that I would have called myself a gatherer, but I would have been the dude hanging back with the
dudes. You know, I'm just going to pretend.
Did they have couch potatos back then?
They had couch tubers. Yes,
I'm currently a freelance gatherer. I'm not working.
Yeah.
I'm just staying back with your wife while you might get killed by a dinosaur. That was impossible.
Gathering is just like a side hustle for you, right?
Yeah, you know, it's just like, look, I've got to have a, you know, it's the gig economy.
That's what I'm doing now. I'm just temporary until I get my own cave. No. So when you study all this stuff, I mean, this is going to, but like, because, you know, I haven't even studied it, but like when you're studying that, you know, you're learning about, you know, like Homo sapiens and the, you know, how the humans evolved and, you know, the beginning. Doesn't it kind of fascinate you, like where it went, that it continued for so long and what it became?
Where we're at now? Yeah.
I mean, oddly, we're not very impressive now, but in a way, it's just odd to think where it started and where it came now. You know, I mean, and now we're at the point, the precipice of we're about to invent something that's going to kill it, make us obsolete, you know, with AI. That's insane to me. We're like living in the sci-fi movie, basically, the beginnings of it.
I was driving over here from that animal sanctuary and I called my dad because I was trying to decide where I was going to do the podcast, damn it. And I called him and we ended up getting into an AI chat about how, because, you know, he was in the film industry in the commercial side for years. And we were talking about the heyday, the glory days of the film industry and how, you know, everybody was paid well and respected and treated, you know, pretty darn well for the jobs that they were doing. And we were talking about, hey, how not only will AI replace everybody in this field, or, you know, that's kind of the fear, but also just everybody.
Yeah.
Up and down. But I do think, you know, for AI to write comedy, it's going to take some time.
Oh yeah. We've already gone through that. It's all dad jokes at this point. So
yeah. Right. Like, I mean, we need some real trauma. They need to get hit by a truck, right? Like, they need to have the creepy uncle. Right. I'm sure
wouldn't that be great? If the world in 30 years is the only job available is comedy.
Right? It's so funny.
We bet
so
on the right horse, huh?
Right. Yeah. My neighbor growing up, she was a casting. She ran casting at Paramount, and she was really nice. But she was. I wanted to be an actress. You know, when I was graduating from high school, and she was just like, "Oh no, get a job that's always going to be there." You know, like actresses who, you know, like they don't need actresses forever. She's like, become a shoe salesman. And then of course, like a few years later, like Zappos or Amazon comes up on, you know, the internet. And it's like, well, that would have gone real well. You know, not everybody can be Al Bundy, but I mean, it is interesting. Like we're on the precipice of like the sixth mass extinction that we're basically causing. And then with the AI, it's like, we're trying to also, I mean, we're like driving ourselves into extinction, because even though we're driving the extinction of all these other species, guess what? We're also an animal too, that is vulnerable to these effects, you know, of climate change that we are deeply affecting and causing climate change. And then AI, it's like,
and I feel like, I know people are talking about it more seriously, but I feel like no one's really it kind of is reminding me of like when Trump was running for president in 2015 and everyone was like, yeah, whatever, whatever. And then like that thing later. And now it's like, I feel like AI is like, you know, this might be bad. Everyone's like, yeah, whatever, whatever. Like, we got to figure out this writer's strike or whatever. And then it's, I don't know. The AI, it terrifies me.
Well, I want to just move on to a different subject real fast. Cause I know you were doing that show Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson, which that guy is like a genius, right? Did you have any background in that? In I guess astronomy would be the word.
No, actually, that's I do not at all. And the reason why I did that show is I met him in 2015. I was at the American Museum of Natural History. They had these holiday parties, and a friend of mine was like, "You need to meet Neil," because at the time I was doing science comedy. Because we kind of got a little sidetracked, but after I did that boobs video, I ended up getting on the Today Show. They had me on that year. And then that snowballed. I hosted a Bigfoot show. And then I did Discovery. And, you know, that's how my sci-com world began. Mm-hmm. Started with boobs. And then I met Neil at this party. And Neil asked, because he knew I knew so many people there. He's like, how do you know people here? And I said, well, I make science, you know, science comedy. And he was like, and he literally said, girl, you need to hit me up. And I was like, excuse me, can you say that again? And he was like, seriously, we need someone like you on the show. And this is December of 2015. And I didn't know this. I was living in LA at the time, but his father was sick. And so it was kind of like back and forth. And then finally in 2017, I came out and I did, we called it Sexy Primatology, where I came on and I talked about, we did a Facebook Live with Chuck Nice and Neil.
Oh,
talking
cool.
About, you know, primate, you know, mating rituals and sexy time. And I did a howler monkey call. And I think that's what really sealed the deal. But I started writing comedy for the show. And, you know, luckily, I mean, a lot of the guests that were on, it covered so many topics. Mm-hmm. You know, we had Anthony Bourdain, Jane Goodall, Jack Black, like all, you know, James Marsden, Mae Jemison, all these.
And when you have like those people, like what would they know things about like certain areas of science or astronomy?
My favorite. Well, that's no. That's,
yeah, Jack Black. You know, he's like won the Nobel Prize.
Well, Jack Black's mom worked in aerospace.
No, wow.
Mm-hmm. So he knew a lot. But my favorite episodes was Katy Perry, because Katy Perry admittedly does not know crap about math or science, and was so endearingly honest about it. You know, because some people, you know, as somebody who, you know, you want to feel like you're not, you know. Mm-hmm. You have a deficit in something. She was just like, she owned it. She's like, I don't understand. Teach me. And it was so lovely that she was just like, this is not my world. Help me. And it was very funny because, you know, it gave him a really cool opportunity to answer a lot of questions that people might have been like, really? You don't know that? But it's like some of them, because he said something like, math is the language of the universe. And she's like, what does that mean? Which I think a lot of people would also say that too.
Right.
What the fuck do you
I would say mean, that right Neil? Now.
Yeah. But she just asked it and it was like, you go. But I also got to dress up Neil as Katy Perry in that episode. That was my
I gotta look that up.
Neil, it was Sasheer Zameda was the comedian on that show, because they'd interview like a luminary and then have like a smaller deal on the studio where it would be Neil, usually another comedian, and then like some scientists would come in. But it was Sasheer Zameda was a comedian, and we had them switch roles or switch. No, she was being Neil. Neil was being Katy Perry. It was like this real weird moment, but I still have the wig that Neil wore.
So you're saying that you performed a drag show. You know, that's not, you can't do that anymore. You can't do that anymore. I'm just a little bitch. No, well, I got a question. If you ever, you probably still talk to him here and there. Can you do me a favor? He's got some pull in that community, right?
In which community? The drag community?
No, sorry.
Do you know something I don't?
The astronomy community. Oh, all right. Yes. All right. You got to do me a favor. We got to get Pluto back as a planet. All right. Does he have any pull on that? Does he even believe that? Because that was some bullshit, man.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. I mean, like I have a lot of astronomy friends now and astrophysicist friends. So I can, Katie Mack is one. I can definitely reach out to her because she's got some big pull. Neil, but like, there's some others that we can
actually don't do that because they'll think you're insane. But I just,
I mean, you have to get it back.
I mean, they already, that ship has sailed.
We need somewhere to move soon. So
right. But if that's only a dwarf planet. So do you want to go to a dwarf planet or a real planet? Come on, buddy.
If robots take over here, we're going to have to go to another planet. And I think like this is probably good. I feel like everything happens so fast now. Like I literally, this AI thing, I think is probably going to happen. Probably about 9 months.
Right.
Yeah.
But nine months left.
It was nice knowing you guys. I mean, I don't know. Did you
We should have you back. We have some robots that are going to be taking over.
So. Right.
I'm sorry.
I'm just going to be ChatGPT, like talking to you. That's where I'll be. But yeah, did you watch T2 growing up?
Oh yeah,
I loved it. I loved both of them, and you know that seemed like you know, first of all, it seemed so like unfathomable and unthinkable. But now it's just first of all, what was the year that it was supposed to have happened? Isn't it like past? Aren't we past?
Yeah, I hate when that happens.
I feel like it's past. I'm like, where is my phone? So this is a fun little movie trivia. My mom lives, her house butts up against Bull Creek, which is the creek they filmed that scene that like in T2 with him on the motorcycle and Eddie Furlong in that.
Oh, I love that thing. They use it in a lot of movies, right?
Yeah, yeah. So we live right.
Is that in? Yeah, is that like in the valley?
Mm-hmm, yeah, San Fernando Valley, SFV 818 representing.
Wow. Yeah, I lived kind of near that guy. I lived in.
Where did you live?
I lived in Studio City
for
not that long, but
sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying I lived right near that and I was always, you know, the thing about I'm from New York City and like I grew up so fascinated and enamored with movies and like that world was so magical to me that I think I always had a problem going to LA because it just seems so weird to me to just be there, like this place I had seen my whole life in these fantasy movies that I was like. And I guess I thought it was cool, but it was always like, it was off-putting to me to be there. Like, I was like, where am I? I'm in like the place where all these movies took place. I didn't like, I just felt like I didn't. And I know this isn't just kind of like solely like my experience. I know a lot of people feel, but whenever I go there, I just feel very out of place, you know, and it brings out like an insecurity that I feel like no one wants me there whenever I'm there. Like no one's happy I'm there. Like,
Tom, I have a little confession to make. That's why I brought you here today, and it's
an intervention to keep you away.
We can't have you back.
Yeah.
No.
Well, you know, it'd be like I'd go there, and it'd be like people would always be like, "Why are you here?" Like that was always kind of. And if I didn't really have a good reason, I felt like I was defending myself. So the only
in fairness, Tom used to break into people's houses. So that's
they'd be like, why are you here? So the only times I really, really felt comfortable was like when I was going there specifically for a thing to do.
Right.
So that was like I felt like I had that in my arsenal. Like people would be like, what are you doing?
I have a show.
I'm doing something. I'm doing a thing here, you know, and it'd be like, oh, okay, cool. So
yeah. Who gave you permission to come to our city?
Yeah. Like I'm working with spider monkeys. Leave me alone.
I'm fucking working with monkeys. Yeah. I funny enough, I have the same thing with New York in terms of like the first time I went to New York. So growing up, like New York to me is Ghostbusters, right? Like it's, you know, that movie or Muppets Take Manhattan. You know what I mean? Like, that is New York to me, you know, Panic in Needle Park, real uplifting films. Yeah. And so the first time I ever went to New York was 3 weeks after 9/11. And I had already had a trip planned. And my best friend, I was 22, and my best friend and I already had this plan. And people were like, you can't go. And it's like, this is the perfect time to go. One, they need the tourism. And two, it's probably they're going to make sure nothing's going to go wrong on that flight.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, I fell in love. Like it was one of, you know, it was 2001 but it was weird. I felt like I was in a dream scape the whole time, minus the King Kong, although the Empire State Building, you know, always, in fact, the first I've moved 12 times when I was in New York, I was in New York for about 5 years and I moved 12 times in those years. And most of my places, you know, I could get a view of the Empire State Building by going up on the roof. It was almost like a prerequisite for my King Kong love. But yeah, I do feel like New York is kind of like that too, where everything is so iconic. It's kind of overwhelming.
Wait, can I ask you this?
Wasn't there a King Kong in the 70s where he was on the Twin Towers? Wasn't that the 70s?
Yeah, that was the Jessica Lange one. Was it the Twin Towers? I guess it was. Was it the Twin Towers? I haven't watched that one. I think
they did
make
it the Twin Towin Towers.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
By the way, the T2 thing is the end of the world, supposed to be 1997, according to that movie.
Yeah.
And that movie came out in 1991?
Yeah.
Yeah. They really cut it close. I guess they had to, because he had already written it in the first one.
We've been slacking.
But another funny thing is, I don't know if you ever saw Escape from New York, which is supposed to be way in the future. Yeah. And like, Manhattan has been turned into a prison where they just throw all the worst criminals in the world. And I remember I watched it recently and it's like 1998. Oh, really?
Well, we're already 8 years past Back to the Future 2. That was 2015. And that was supposed to be the future. So, yeah.
I did a talk in 2015. Actually, it's so funny. I remember, I can't believe that was 8 years ago now. But yeah, I brought that up. Like, where's our hoverboard? Like, we really got screwed there. Like, what's up with that?
I know. That was the one thing they needed to figure out. And they just didn't. I feel like they just spent all their time on that. Hoverboards. I don't know. You know, we'll see. Can I ask you, we're going to finish up, so we'll let you go. I want to ask you, so like, you said you had those dreams about the King Kong thing. Did you ever do any research or like what that might have meant, what those dreams might have been signaling in your subconscious, or did you ever even try approach finding?
Because
that?
Don't dreams always mean something?
That's what I thought.
Ideally, right? I mean, that's kind of it was more of like an anxiety. People told me that was probably some sort of fear or anxiety being played out. I was so young though when they started. I must have been, because it was before. We lived in a house in Granada Hills, which is, you know, down the road. And I was probably three when I started getting them. So I don't know what the heck. Something was.
Well, you want to hear what Google says?
Yeah. What does Google say? Tell me.
What does it mean when you dream about King Kong? It can symbolize rage or anger or an aspect power that is not being expressed. I still don't really understand that. But anyway.
I feel like that could be the explanation for every person ever.
Do you guys?
Oh, here's another one. This also says, there's another one. It says it indicates your high level of intelligence. So I would go with that one. Dreaming about gorillas means you're smart. Yeah.
I still get them. I still get the King Kong dreams. So it's like Ghostbusters too, where I'll be lucid dreaming. And because I do it pretty regularly where I can control my dreams, but like I'll be in a dream and I'll be doing what I want. And if I think of something quote unquote bad, like King Kong, or if I'm in the water, if I think of sharks, and I love sharks, I'm really trying not to be afraid of them. I have friends that do shark diving, but they will show up and they will kill me. But it's almost like in Ghostbusters where he's, you know, at the end where they're like, clear your mind and you know, they're, you know.
Stave Puff Mark.
Choose your destructor, and it's like I could choose my destructor in my dreams, and they come and decimate me. So it's almost like a lack of control too. They say that like losing your teeth is kind of like
I have that one.
Dream about that. That's like a losing control kind of thing. So
I'm really into dream, you know, interpretation. Like I really, dissection. I'm very, and I, for a while,
Tom dreams about Mothra, right? Is it Mothra or Godzilla? Yeah. Which one do you do? Both of them. Right?
I love Godzilla.
Just a three-way with and the Mothra. Three of us.
Are you a throuple in this dream?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's having some lesbian, monkey love triangle.
I love this.
It's funny because I figured out later, because you know, there's you can Google like dream dictionary and it'll tell you like dream symbols and what they mean. But you know, someone told, you know, I was reading a lot and people were like, you can't look those up because they're not universal. Like different symbols mean different things to different people. So it's not universal. But it's funny, what happened to me a lot is I'll just have some kind of like tame, you know, dream about something that seems like it's nothing. Like it'll be about like, you know, I'm swimming or something. And then I'll be like, oh, I wonder what this means. And a lot of times it'll end up being some horrible thing. Like it'll be like, this means like you don't get laid. You know? Like, wait a minute, what? It was just like, I saw like a bear.
Did you ever have, Tom, did you ever have a wet dream, a legit wet dream in your life? I had one. And
you just wanted to tell your story.
What? Oh, I'm sorry. Were you not finished?
No. Go ahead. I mean, not in a long time. It's been hours.
It's the only time I ever remember it, though. I was dreaming about water, and you know, it wasn't like a major. It was like a teenager. It was like discharge or something like that.
So I had a wet nightmare. The honorable discharge. I was being pulled by a werewolf. first of all, I was thinking about the other day, the whole, the dream that repeats itself. What is it called?
The recurring dream.
Yeah. The recurring dream. Like, I don't think I've ever had that. I think I had it when I was really little a few times, but the fact that some people have that is kind of fascinating to me.
You don't have the one. I mean, the one I always, and a lot of people I ask it, the one where you're back in school and you don't know where the test is. Sometimes you're naked, sometimes you're not, that kind of thing. It's like the finals. You can't find the classroom or you don't know what's on the test. You ever have that one?
I have. Have you ever had it, Natalia, where you're back in studying anthropology?
Yeah, watch. I'm specifically anthropology. No, I get the school one. I get also theater, like being on stage and not having having anything prepared.
Yes, I've had that too. I'm not even an actor.
Anthropology, because I have the law school dream all the time, where I'm back like my first semester of law school, because it was such a stressful time, the hardest school I ever had. So like when I have that dream and then I wake up and I'm like 5 years out of school, I'm like, oh my God, it was the most terrifying. That's more terrifying to me than.
But then you wake up and you feel good because it's not real.
Yeah, you recovered.
I do. Yeah. Sort of. But then I like, and then I have to do shit today. So what is you know, you've done comedy in LA and New York. What can you give your take on the differences or what you like better or how they are different? Or
it's funny. Yeah. It's, you know, it's so funny. I really have only been pushing it really hard in LA the past 6 months or so. I did it in New York before I moved, but
she's good. She talks about monkey clits too. Oh, I like thank that.
You. Yeah. Lots of monkey clits, dicks. You know, chips, whips, whatever you name it. But yeah, no, I did it like in New York. Well, I did stand up a little bit in LA, and then when I moved to New York, I did it more. But then I really wasn't pushing it, and I'm kind of bummed I didn't. And so now in LA, now I've got this really interesting perspective of New York pre-pandemic, and then LA now, and New York now a little bit, you know. And the New York scene is like, there you can do a show every night, right? Like if you wanted to do a show every night and book it like last minute. Which I didn't realize that when I was like hounding Eric, you know, like a month before I'm coming to town. And he's just like, message me when you're here.
Yeah.
Oh, because in LA, Eric, if you don't message them 3 months earlier, you know, like they're like, we have nothing.
I know, but yeah. And it's hard. It's the hardest. But with here, there's so much stuff. And it's like people ask me 6 months out. I'm like, I'm not your agent. Like, you think there's some guy I'm going to my assistant? Put this guy in 6 months from now. I'm like, just hit me when you're here, you know?
Exactly. That's the difference. It's I like that, though. It's so nice. Yeah. Whereas here, I'm just like, I'm having to, it's not, you know, and people are supportive in different ways in both places. In LA, they're, you know, there's prickliness at the beginning with both places, right? Where like people don't really know what to think of you at first, but then there is like a camaraderie. Like I have my camaraderie with some comics coming up here in LA, and now I've got some within New York that I'm really excited about. Like Lizzie, I hung out with Lizzie, who's a comic.
Oh, right. She's great.
Yeah, she's awesome. And she did a couple shows in LA, and I was able to come out. And it was really kind of fun to see, you know, her do her thing here and out in New York. So it's definitely, there's more opportunity in New York because there's just so much going on. In LA, you have to compete with bigger headliners. So that's kind of, and there's not like a, like there's not a village, right? Like there's not like an area where there's like six clubs in like three block radius that have like four shows a night.
Right. It is funny though, because like that is a big thing about New York, and you do hear that a lot. Like, you know, everyone's like, oh, you can get up so much in New York. And then like, you know, when I was doing stand up more, you know, living in New York, I was kind of like, really? I could be getting up every night? Like, what's going on? Like, what?
It's easier to get around too. So you can, like, there are comics who just will get a room for a night and just, I mean, you did that one night too, Tom, but just invite your friends. And in New York, it's easier. Like in LA, everything's so spread out. I think it's harder to get people to come a lot because it just takes forever to get somewhere, you know?
There's also a lot of bringer shows in LA.
Yeah.
a lot of radio shows, which, because of what you just said, are so hard. Like, I came back from, oh, this is so sad. I came back from New York this last trip and I had, like, I did 12 shows in 2 weeks. I was so happy. I was like, oh my God, I felt like a comic. I was like, yeah, this was so great. And I had such a, just a good run. And a lot of people came out and supported. And I had a show that Friday in LA. It was a bringer show and I had to bring three people and I had three people, but then two of them had to work because it was an earlier show and I only had one person and they were like, yeah, you only get to do 5 minutes tonight.
Oh, come on.
You know? And I was like, oh, but I get it. But at the same time, it's tough. You know, people have to do what they got to do. So
I remember doing definitely a bringer show really early on here where, and I remember those bringers when I did that, like, the amount of anxiety, you know, associated with those shows of your people showing up and you have to make sure they're there and you keep, like, you know, following up with them and hounding them. But I remember I did one, I just moved back because I'd done comedy in LA for a couple of years and I just moved back. And I think I had to bring like four people and I think like two showed up and I swear the guy was like, yeah, so you, not all your people showed up. So I'm going to light you at two. And I was like, I'm sorry, what did you say? He's like, yeah, you're gonna do 3 minutes because only like three of your people showed up, so I'm gonna let you too. And I was just like, you're really gonna do this? Like, really a thing you're going to, like, what am I gonna do? And then I was just like, oh, okay. And I'm like, I'm just not getting off the stage, like, fuck you. So that was a, and I remember that being a thing of like, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to keep doing this. Cause I feel like there's, I don't know if you've experienced this thing probably in comedy or entertainment. There's a lot of like, there are a lot of moments where it's like, you know what? I think I'm done with this. And then something random will happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Back in. Oh, yeah. And you're almost like, fuck you. Like, stop.
God damn it.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like the mob, like it's like a cult or the mob. Once you're out, then they want you back in.
Right. But in all fairness, and I say this comics all the time, because I'm starting to become like a quasi therapist to comics. They're just unloading all their issues, you know, because they know I'll listen, but it's supposed to be hard. That's the point. Yeah. Like, if everyone could be successful, like, there needs to be a weeding out process a little bit.
Well, there's weeding out and then there's, you know,
no, that's a dick move there, but I'm just saying.
No, I know. Not even that. But that was definitely, yeah, I probably, a normal person probably would have been like, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Right. You know, but like brand new comics being like, oh, how come I'm not on the main show on Saturday night? I'm like, there's a hierarchy here. You got to move up, you know?
I hear that in science communication too, which, you know, I get it to an extent, but I'll hear young, like, new science communicators coming in and being like, God, I've been pitching a show for 2 years. And I'm like, try 13, you know? And like, not even, that's just 13 of me doing science communication. There's a whole nother decade and a half of doing, you know, acting, right? This is a long, you know, there's no such thing as an overnight success. Often, I mean, it's so incredibly rare that somebody just walks in and it just like, pop, falls in your lap. Yeah. And even then, I don't even know if I'd want that because you wouldn't be fully prepared. And also have, yeah. I mean, I'm going to, when something finally, cause I still pitch science comedy shows, that's what I do. Mm. And, you know, we're getting, I'm getting closer and closer. I've had a few close calls in the past few years, but it's, you know, it's tough. And,
yeah, but you're ready. Cause I mean, I see, we talk about this a lot and we'll wrap it up soon, is that, some of the TikTok people who got big on TikTok, but they're not comedians and they have all these followers. And I'm like, yeah, but you still got to do the steps here. And, you know, you have the experience. So when it happens for you, you're going to be ready. A lot of these people can't back it up.
Yeah. I was going to say, cause did we have this? I feel like you and I might have had this conversation in New York where, or maybe with somebody else, but a lot of TikTokers are now trying to do comedy and they show up and they want the 12, 15 minutes, but they can't because they've never done stand up. They've only done TikTok, which are two totally different beasts. So that's another thing. I think people think that because they've done one thing that it easily translates, like, you know, with, like, in terms of science communication, a lot of science communicators might be good at it, but if they don't know the field of the entertainment field, then, like, you know, good luck. And they'll bitch about it and complain, like, why is it like this? And they have every right to, because there's a lot of things that should change, you know, but at the same time, if you don't know it, how are you going to change it?
It also makes sense that they wouldn't be able to really do stand up because it's kind of like, you know, they're not at all related. It's kind of like being like, I don't know. It's weird. Like, almost being surprised you can't do 15 minutes of comedy when you're like, I don't understand. How come I can't do it? I've danced in my living room.
Right. I did all the challenges.
So,
And especially because you're in science too, which is even funnier. Because imagine like going to a doctor and they're like, listen, what's your experience? Well, I've been doing this for 3 months, but I got like a million followers on TikTok. You'd be like, yeah, I'm going to go to a different brain surgeon.
On medical TikTok. I've been doing playing the game Operation on TikTok.
Oh my God.
So this is my last question. So what's harder? I think I know the answer, but studying science or doing comedy?
Oh God. It's almost equal billing, really. I mean, our, you know, terribleness. I don't know. I mean, I feel comedy, I think is,
what is your
big funny thing is I do them mostly together. You know, that's
you don't get heckled doing science. Someone's not going to be like, will you call that a telescope? What the fuck? You know?
Well, you will get like, say, for instance, if you're trying to publish, you will get like reviewer number two. Reviewer number two is a heckler. They will sit there and rip apart your paper. And, you know, I've had papers get kicked back. I had one paper that never got published because I knew who the reviewer was. I knew it was somebody who worked in my area, too. And I think he was a little miffed that I wasn't citing him enough. In fact, he said that I wasn't citing him enough. And that's how I figured out it was him. But you know what I mean? So like there is the same amount of competitiveness.
Is that peer review? Is that what that is?
Peer review. Yeah. Yeah.
So the peer reviewers are like the trolls of the science world.
Yeah. Sometimes they can be really nice, but sometimes they can just be jerks to be jerks. And they can be like, they can eat their own. You know what I mean? Like, they're a lot like Democrats. And I say that as one, but like the scientific community will sometimes eat their own to make themselves look better. And it's really, I've been called out online before by scientists and I've been like, wait a minute, we're on the same team. Why are you doing this? Just like call in, don't call out. But yeah, comedy though, I mean, it can be absolutely brutal. So I think that by combining the two, I don't know if I'm being the ultimate masochist or I'm hoping it cancels each other out.
Yeah.
But okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. At least the trolls, to troll me in comedy, you know, I guess maybe you have to know a little bit of science, or you can just, I don't know, maybe somebody is going to be out there knows a lot about snake clits and is going to correct snake me.
Yeah, your comedy and stuff you talk about probably makes you hard to troll for just, yeah. Like, I don't even know where, I don't understand some of this. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've heard a lot of snake clit comedy. That's like kind of like the hack. It's like airline food kind of comedy. But you still do it. I'm joking. No, I've never seen snake clit comp.
You get a bunch of snake clit material and then had to follow them. Like,
dude, I had, well, you know, what's so funny. I did a show. It was called D's Nuts. And I was like, I have to do a bunch of ball comedy. Cause I know a lot of, I mean, I know a lot about balls. I can tell you all about like sperm, you know, ejaculate, loads and things like that, and you know, talk to you about like.
All right. Well, now you're telling us we have to end the show.
I know. Sorry, I'm gonna leave it on a. These are the low hanging fruit, guys. But yeah, no, but I did a bunch of ball jokes in this show, and the poor girl after me was like, "Well," because she had a bunch of ball jokes, and I was like, "Well, I'll be damned."
But she didn't have like heady ball jokes, right?
Like, yeah, they were more heady ball jokes.
Yeah.
But yeah, they still landed. She was great. She was fantastic. Mine just were like super dorky science.
Like more techno. I mean, that stuff's probably pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
DNA satchels.
Yeah.
Brainer biscuits.
DNA satchels. Yeah. That's something you always want to hear during sex.
Put your DNA satchels on my chin. Just like that.
Yeah. That's my favorite.
I love that I'm doing this at my mom's house. I don't know if she's listening.
Yeah. That seems like a cool thing to get into too. Science porn.
I used to co-host a porn parody podcast and or porncast, and I used to bring a lot of the science to it. Actually, I would, you know, we'd watch porn parodies like Fap to the Future or Star Wars XXX, Saving Privates Ryan's or Ryan's Privates, like, things like that.
Fact check it or.
I would fact check it. I would definitely do that. Especially my favorite was Star Wars XXX, where Chewbacca, I did a video about Chewbacca's penis, by the way, if you want to see it, it's on Instagram. But there was a sex scene between Chewbacca and I believe a stormtrooper. But it was interesting because there is question about would Chewbacca have more of a dog dong or of a, you know, a human, you know, baloney pony. And as you can imagine, he did have a human baloney pony. So it answered a lot of questions for me. I was scientifically, you know, intrigued.
Yeah. Star Wars fans had a field day with that one. Like,
right, exactly.
This is bullshit.
Chewbacca Chubbs.
Hey, Luke and Leia made out in one scene, and they were brother and sister. So that got a little weird, that whole Star Wars.
At the end of the day, that Star Wars porn is probably better than Phantom Menace. So. Okay, so we'll wrap this up. Thank you. I want to thank our guest, Natalia Reagan, for coming on. And where can they check you out? What's all your handles and stuff?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Natalia13Reagan, on TikTok at BeholdNatalia. And I have a Patreon if you want to check that out. I post, behind the scenes stuff. And yeah, just come check out, see what shows I've got going on.
She'll be in New York this weekend.
Yes, I'm going to be in New York coming out. Oh, yeah. I don't know when this is coming out, but
tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Oh, sweet. Mm. I'm coming out. I'm doing a show at Caveat on a Friday night in the Lower East Side, doing a show about gay animals and just homosexuality across the animal kingdom. So that should be a lot of fun. I'll be doing shows with Eric. I'm not sure exactly where. You could probably
Broadway and Greenwich.
Broadway and Greenwich this Saturday and Sunday. I'm very excited. And there'll probably be more. So just follow me and stalk me, but not in the creepy way.
Okay. Perfect.
And send news.
Creepy guys always take that caveat very seriously. Stalk. Yeah. Don't be creepy about it.
I know. Oh, God.
No, you'll be good. all right. Well, thanks a lot. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next time on LE2B. Bye-bye.
Bye.